Hello?
Hello, this is Hamburg speaking.
Welcome. Okay, I think Madhavan has sent us a regular PDF file, not in the landscape mode, it's in the portrait mode. So we just have to, Madhavan, it's better if you could tell us what slide you're using at any given time, okay? At least periodically.
Sure. You will let me know when to start, right?
Yeah, Jorge will.
Yeah, okay.
Well, so before starting, so welcome everyone to the Spring 08 edition of the International Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar. We're going to have a seminar every 2 weeks. There's a little bit of a break, so not to interfere with the Zakopane meeting in Poland. And we still have 3 open slots for the semester, so if you want to speak, you better get in touch with me fast, because I'm pretty sure it'll fill up fast. I guess since no one else is calling in, we might as well start. So our speaker today will be Madhavan from the Raman Research Institute, speaking about the quantum gravity and the information loss problem. Madhavan?
Okay. So let's start on page 1, which is just the title page. I'll be talking about some ideas as to how an underlying theory of quantum gravity can help elucidate the information loss problem. The plan of the talk will be as follows. First, I will review the standard picture of black hole evaporation due to Hawking and the ensuing information loss problem. Next, I will describe an alternate view of how black hole evaporation may proceed due to Ashtekar and Boyewald. And this view rests on the expectation that the classical singularities, or GR, are resolved by quantum gravity. Since one does not have available a full theory of quantum gravity yet, the proposal is necessarily qualitative. So in order to bring a bit more of precision to this proposal, as well as to study it in a simpler context, I will come to the third and main part of the talk, which will be about a toy model of black holes, wherein one can make significant progress towards non-perturbative quantization. And we shall then see how, re-examine Ashtekar and Boyewald's ideas in the context of that model. So let me start then with page 2 by telling you a little bit about classical black holes, just reminding you what they are. So a classical black hole is, of course, a configuration of the gravitational field from which light cannot escape out to infinity, and that is represented by the first Penrose diagram. So you have this time-like line which represents the collapsing matter, and the wiggly line, which is a singularity. And if I go out to future null infinity, sky plus, and I look down upon the space-time, I do not see the full space-time, and hence I say there is a black hole. An important part of the definition of a black hole is that future null infinity has to be geodesically complete. So it has to be ruled by null geodesics, which are complete. This is important because it rules out examples which are really not basically not black holes, and this is illustrated by the second Penrose diagram, which is just flat space-time with a piece of it cut off. Here too, if I go and stand at future null infinity and I look down upon the space-time, I do not see the full space-time, but I know there is no black hole, and technically what happens is that future null infinity is not complete, it's just chopped off, it's not geodesically complete. Go to page 3. So while a black hole does not radiate just by definition classically, quantum mechanically it can radiate, and this was of course shown by Hawking in his seminal work in the 70s. wherein he looked at the problem in the context of a physically well-motivated approximation, namely that of quantum field theory in curved space-time. So he considered a black hole background and a test quantum field on that black hole background, and he was led to conclude through his calculations that a black hole spontaneously radiates at late times, just as a black body would, and the temperature which characterizes this radiation is the Hawking temperature, TTH, which is basically inversely proportional to the mass, capital M, of the black hole. And because of the factors of Planck mass, MP, in the first line, you can see that the temperature is extremely small for astrophysically sized black holes. Because the temperature is inversely proportional to the mass, it suggests the following cycle, that you have radiation. Because the black hole has lost mass through radiation, it has a lower mass and hence a higher temperature, and this goes to more radiation and so on, and this is of course black hole evaporation. What are the timescales relevant to this process? Turns out that this process is an extremely slow process, and this can be estimated as follows. There are two timescales which are relevant. One is the evaporation timescale, which can be just estimated by the rate of mass loss, so that is capital M divided by M dot, where capital M dot is the rate of mass loss simply through black body radiation. So I just stick in the Hawking temperature using the sigma T to the fourth law. On the other hand, if one perturbs the black hole and one asks how long it takes, does the geometry take to settle down, that time can be estimated as a settling down time, just given by the light travel time across the black hole, which is just the Schwarzschild radius divided by the speed of light. And if one takes the ratio of these two, T settling down divided by T evaporation, as you can see, is extremely small until the black hole reaches around the size of a Planck unit. Therefore, one can model this process as a quasi-static process, namely that of a one-parameter family of black holes of ever-decreasing mass. So this is, let me now go to page 4. The relevant diagram, Penrose diagram, is given on page 4. And here we have, as usual, the collapse in matter. The arrow represents Hawking radiation. And the strength of the singularity decreases from left to right. And at the intersection of the dotted line with this wiggly line, that is sort of the end point of evaporation, at which stage one has a Planck mass object and a whole bunch of Hawking radiation. The initial matter, which started out either at past time-like infinity or at past null infinity, is in a pure quantum state. After collapse, we have, as I said, radiation and this Planck mass remnant. And the only way this can be pure is if the Planck mass remnant has enough correlation with the thermal Hawking radiation. Since one can estimate this, and it turns out that the black hole remnant, the Planck mass remnant, has to have a huge number of internal states, and such remnants can simply be ruled out from effective field theory calculations. Just low energy physics and unitarity demands that such remnants cannot exist. So, therefore one is left with this conundrum that one started with a pure quantum state and one ends up in a state which is mixed. And this is the information loss problem. Let me now go to page 5. So, while it seems that the picture is very robust because it rests on this quasi-static approximation, it turns out that there is a loophole in the general argumentation, and this is as follows. While it is true that the evaporation process is extremely slow, it is also true that the lifetime of the black hole is extremely large, and therefore small secular corrections can accumulate and after sufficiently long can give a picture which is qualitatively different from the diagram which was on page 4. So I will sketch now one alternate view of black hole evaporation due to Ashtekar and Boyewald, and this view rests on the following observation. about the standard Hawking diagram on page 4, namely that the endpoint of evaporation is not just a plasma remnant and radiation, but because the singularity is space-like, there is also a singular boundary to the space-time. Intuitively, therefore, it seems that the information which appears to be lost has simply gone into the singularity, and if one assumes that physics simply ends at the singularity, then yes, it seems likely that information is lost. However, the singularity is a place where we do not believe classical GR will still be valid, and where a theory of quantum gravity takes over. As from new quantum gravity toy models, it turns out, of course, that quantum singularities are resolved by the underlying quantum theory, and if one believes that this will also be true for the full theory, then one immediate consequence is that the event horizon is no longer a useful concept. Recall that the event horizon is a very global structure. You have to wait all the way till the space-time has evolved and look upon the space-time from future null infinity, and therefore it is sensitive to the entire geometry of the space-time. Since one cannot trust classical geometry near the singularity, it's not clear if changes in the classical geometry near the singularity can completely wipe away the event horizon. In fact, this is actually what happens, as shown by a paper by Hagitek, wherein he alters the geometry within a plant length of the singularity and nowhere else. And just by this means, the event horizon disappears. Hence, the event horizon is not going to be a useful concept once we bring in quantum effects and we alter the effective geometry of the singularity. So what can we replace by the event horizon? As all of you know, there is a more quasi-local characterization of what a black hole is, which has been developed by Abhay and lots of collaborators, which goes by the name of a dynamical horizon. A dynamical horizon is a smooth three-dimensional hypersurface permeated by marginally trapped two surfaces. So this is what encapsulates the idea, at least quasi-locally, that light is trapped and cannot escape. The dynamical horizon has properties which relate its geometry to the matter which is falling in. And in particular, if there is infalling matter falls into a dynamical horizon, the dynamical horizon is space-like and its area increases much like that of an apparent horizon. If there is no matter falling in, then the dynamical horizon is null and the area of the dynamical horizon cross-section remains constant, much like the event horizon of a stationary black hole. Finally, if matter comes out, that is, if the dynamical horizon is actually radiating, then it turns around and becomes time-like and the area decreases. So putting these ingredients all together, Ashtekar and Bojewal has the following picture, which is exemplified by the Penrose diagram on page 6. So on page 6, we have path null infinity square minus. There's collapsing matter which started out, say, from time minus or from past time-like infinity. The singularity, which was the curly line, is now smeared out and is replaced by some quantum space-time, some quantum geometry region. A dynamical horizon starts out, and as long as the matter is collapsing, the dynamical horizon is space-like. All the matter collapses inside, and the dynamical horizon becomes null, but then it starts radiating through Hawking radiation, and hence it turns around, becomes time-like. So what evaporates in this picture is the area of the dynamical horizon. Physics does not come to an end at the singularity. There is physics and life beyond the singularity. And therefore, the arena for what is happening is extended from the classical Penrose diagram, or even the semi-classical one due to Hawking. There is an extension of space-time beyond the singularity. And because of this extension, what can happen is that a significant fraction of the collapsing matter can go through this quantum space-time region and emerge, so to speak, on the other side of what used to be the classical singularity, and its correlation with the Hawking radiation can restore purity of the state. So this is how one believes or one envisages that the information loss problem can be overcome by quantum gravity effects. So this is a suitable place to pause. If there are any questions, then I can take them now. Okay, so there are no questions.
Wait a minute, Madhavan. Let me ask people if they hear an echo. I guess we hear a small echo, but we can go on.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So let me know, before going to the toy model, which I will be talking about, let me make a small brief digression on page 7, which has to do with the nature of particles in quantum field theory. So the particle concept in quantum field theory is both non-local and observer-dependent, and these are just sort of two-line arguments to remind you of this fact. So why is it non-local? Well, if you take, for example, a free-scalar field, and you take the operator value distribution phi hat of xt, how does the particle concept come about? Well, you just expand this in terms of the sum of plane waves, and the coefficients of these plane waves are operator value, and they are the annihilation creation operators of the theory. And the creation operator creates, labeled by A, creates a particle with momentum h bar k and with wave function, which is that of the plane wave. And hence it is extremely spread out in space-time. It's not a local concept. One can do better by taking wave packets, but one can really never localize a particle. Particles are also observer-dependent. So if you have two sets of observers, one which have coordinates little x and t, and the other which have coordinates little y and capital T, let these observers expand the same field operator. Let's assume that such an expansion can exist. So let them expand the same field operator in their individual plane wave basis. Since bases are different, the coefficients are going to be different, and hence the creation annihilation operators, so the two in general would be different. Hence, if one has annihilation operator A hat and the other has annihilation operator B hat, this vacuum state for A, which is annihilated by the operator A hat, may not be annihilated by the operator B hat of K. And this simply is another way of saying that the vacuum state for one set of observers looks like it has particles for the other set of observers. So with this brief digression, because this is going to play a role in what I have to say, let me now go on to page number 8, which is the model I'm going to be interested in. So this model is called the Callan-Giddings-Harvey-Strominger model, after the people who proposed it. And it's kind of a heavy transparency, so let me go through it slowly. So the action is written in the first two lines, and of course the details are not really important. I will tell you what features of this are important, and I will again summarize it on the next page. So the variables in this action are a two-dimensional Lorentzian metric, GAB, dilaton, a scalar field called the dilaton, which is phi, and a conformally coupled matter field, F. There are two coupling constants in this action. One is the two-dimensional Newton's constant, which has dimensions of inverse mass times inverse length. And the other is this constant kappa, which I will just call, for lack of a better name, the cosmological constant, and it has dimensions of inverse length. Next, let us write down the equations of motion which follow from this action. And the best way to do it is to fix a gauge, fix some coordinates, and then write down the equations. Since we are in two dimensions, the metric is conformally flat, And I can write, for example, the contravariance metric, GAB, as a conformal factor, omega, times a slack metric, eta AB. And eta then has inertial coordinates, little t and z, so that one can form the null coordinates, z plus minus, as t plus minus z. It's useful in order to write the equations in a compact manner to do some couple of variable redefinitions on the Dillerton gravity sector. So these do not involve the conformally coupled matter field S. The first is just taking the exponential of the Dillerton field and calling it a new field capital phi. And the second is a variable capital theta, which involves the space-time geometry, which is encapsulated simply by this conformal factor omega, and capital phi. Right? So we just define this theta equal to phi times omega inverse, and omega then can be expressed in terms of phi and theta. In terms of these coordinates and these variables, the equations of motion are as follows. Since the matter field is conformally coupled, that is, since square root of GGAB in the first line, second line of the action, only depends on the conformal class of the metric, matter actually just satisfies the free scalar field equation on eta AB, on the slack spacetime. Therefore, one can just solve for it, and S is just equal to S plus, plus S minus, or Z minus, the standard decomposition into right and left mobiles. The rest of the equations of motion then separate out into evolution equations and boundary conditions. The evolution equations involve phi and theta, and notice that the second evolution equation on its right-hand side has the stress energy tensor T plus minus of the scalar field. Since the scalar field is conformally coupled, it has vanishing trace classically, and that term classically is zero. However, as we shall see, in the quantum theory, this is no longer the case, and hence I'm just going to leave it there. The boundary conditions involve equations which relate once again phi and theta to the remaining components of the stress energy tensor, T plus plus and T minus minus, and these boundary conditions are prescribed at the past null infinities of the two-dimensional space-time. The bottom line is that one can specify the matter field, that is, one can specify S plus and S minus, and one can solve using the boundary conditions and the evolution equations for the Dillerton and the conformal factor, or for phi and theta in terms of the stress energy of the matter field. Plus, the true degrees of freedom of this model are just S plus and S minus. So just to summarize what I said in words on page 9, the basic points are as follows. The variables of the theory are the scalar field, which is the Dillerton, a two-dimensional metric, and this conformally coupled matter field. Two dimensions implies conformal slackness, and therefore the geometry is specified entirely by a conformal factor. There are some variable redefinitions in the Dillerton metric sector, so we go to new variables, capital phi and capital theta, and the only thing to remember is this conformal factor is the combination capital phi, capital theta inverse. The matter is conformally coupled, and so doesn't see this conformal factor, and so satisfies the free wave equation on the flat spacetime, which the physical spacetime is conformal to. The remaining equations enable phi and theta to be solved in terms of the matter stress energy tensor, which in turn is determined by the data S plus, S minus, and so this data are the true degrees of freedom of the theory. So, let me now describe a couple of classes of solutions to this, these equations in just in terms of Penrose diagrams. So, let's go to page 10. And the simple solution is obtained simply by switching off the matter field. So, S minus and S plus are both zero. And then what one has, not surprisingly, is just Minkowski spacetime. So, the conformal factor omega is equal to 1. And the important point, which I will emphasize time and again, is that this space-time has as a manifold the entire Z plus, Z minus plane. So this is the space-time metric on the complete Z minus, Z plus plane. The interesting solutions are described on page 11. And these are the black hole space-time solutions in which F minus has to be set equal to 0. So if one does this, then one gets black hole space-time. Otherwise, one does not get black hole space-time. So if one takes F minus equal to 0, then there is only F plus, and the Penrose diagram has been drawn below. So since we're in two dimensions, the situation is slightly different from the spherical collapse case of four dimensions, where one has RT plane. Here one has the Z plus Z minus plane, and therefore there is both a left infinity and a right infinity. So we have left null infinity, right null infinity, left future infinity, and right future infinity. The matter data, S plus, is represented by these two parallel lines in which there are dots. And matter collapses to form this singularity, which is the wiggly line. And before matter collapses, it's a curiosity of this solution that you actually have back space time before the matter starts collapsing. If one now goes to right future null infinity, that is chi plus right, and one looks down upon the space time, one does not see the full space time, and therefore there is a horizon and there is a black hole. And indeed, there, if one actually looks at future null infinity, that is chi plus right, it turns out that chi plus right is geodesically complete, and so really there is a black hole. One might think that there would also be a black hole from the point of view of observers on left future null infinity, that is on chi plus left. And indeed, if one looks down from chi plus left, one does not see the full space time. However, it turns out that chi plus left is not null geodesically complete, and therefore the singularity is really left naked. Hence, if one wants to learn about Hawking evaporation and about things relevant to a black hole, it is necessary to concentrate on the physics really near chi plus right. So this is, of course, a model, and a model has its own advantages and disadvantages, and it's a little bit of an art to bring out lessons which are useful for the case one is really interested in physically, which is a four-dimensional case. And here, it is a limitation of the model that the sort of left future structure is not, firstly, it's not even present in a realistic four-dimensional spherical collapse, and even whatever structure is there is not really representative of a black hole. So one will really be considering things which are happening more or less from sky minus left going to sky plus right. That will be the flavor of things to follow. So let me pause again if there are any questions. Okay. So I've shown you that the model exhibits black hole solutions. So next question is there a Hawking effect? And the answer is yes. One can compute this effect in the same approximation as Hawking used, namely in the approximation of quantum field theory on curved spacetime. So one takes the black hole spacetime geometry, which I have just specified as classical and non-fluctuating, and on this one puts quantum test field, which is also conformally coupled, but this is just a quantum test field. It does not backreact on the geometry, and the geometry does not backreact to its stress energy tensor. And one can then take a vacuum state on sky minus left. So again, because the test field is conformally coupled, it splits into minus and plus modes. So one can prescribe on sky minus left a vacuum state. And one can ask, given this state, what do observers at sky plus right actually see? And the calculation simply by Wobbleberg coefficients a la Hawking has been done by Giddings and Nelson, and tells us that at late times, observers at sky plus right see thermal radiation, that is Hawking radiation, but unlike the case of four dimensions, the temperature of this radiation is independent of the mass. So this is another sort of minor difference from what happens in four dimensions. But conceptually, there is Hawking radiation, there is evaporation, and there is an ensuing information loss problem. The temperature is simply given by the cosmological constant times h bar. There is another way of seeing if there is a Hawking effect in the space-time, and that is simply to try and evaluate the expectation value of the stress energy tensor in this state, which I have described to you, namely the vacuum state at psi minus left. So the stress energy tensor is quadratic in this test scalar field, and therefore we have to multiply this test scalar field at the same point with itself, and this is of course an ill-defined operation, and in order to get a meaningful answer one has to regularize, and this can be done by point splitting. So one separates scalar fields, the arguments of the scalar fields by a geodesic, and then one brings the two points to coincidence and subtracts out the divergent piece. If one does this in a proper way, then one can calculate the expectation value of the stress energy tensor unambiguously in two dimensions, and it turns out that the stress energy tensor has a classical part plus an ordered H-bar correction. So for example, if one would compute the trace of the stress energy tensor, that is the T plus minus component, then it turns out to be proportional to the scalar curvature, and this is of course the famous stress energy tensor anomaly, which was found by, I guess, Christensen and Fulham. So one can go ahead and compute this expectation value of this test quantum field stress energy tensor and evaluate the minus minus component at scry plus right, and one finds that the minus minus stress energy is really exactly thermal flux at temperature kappa H bar at late times. So this is another way of seeing that there is the Hawking effect. Let me now go to page 12. So unlike in full gravity, in this model one can make some progress towards the full quantum theory. We do not yet know what the full quantum theory is. I think I've forgotten to mention actually, this part of the talk is collaborative work done with Abhay and Victor Taveras. So, what can we do towards the full quantum theory? We can sketch a framework, and there are gaps which I will point out to, but the very framework itself seems quite robust, and is, as I shall argue, yields important insights as to how the black hole evaporation process may proceed, and in particular, how information loss problem can be resolved. So since the scalar field classically satisfies the free wave equation, we shall take it also to be the case in the quantum theory. That's a very natural thing to do. So one has an operator value distribution which satisfies the free wave equation on eta AB. Therefore, it can be quantized just using Fock space methods in terms of right and left mover. So one has operator value distributions f hat plus and f hat minus, each of which depend only on z plus and z minus. It's important to note the following. This is a remark I should have made with regard to page 11. The spacetime of page 11 is, by virtue of the fact that one has a singularity, it is only a subset of the full Minkowskian plane. So one has a z plus z minus plane, and because there is a singularity, the part of the z plus z minus plane above the curly wiggly line on page 11 is cut out. So coming back to page 12, we are now in quantum theory. This is full quantum theory. We are not talking about any particular classical solution. Different classical solutions occupy different parts of the full Minkowskian plane. As I already showed you, if one has no matter at all, then one has the full Minkowskian plane. Otherwise, one has some subsets thereof. Hence, the arena for quantum theory, the natural arena, is really the full z plus z minus plane. And you will see why I'm emphasizing this point again and again as we go ahead. So, just to summarize that point, one has a free scalar field, a quantum operator, one has a standard Fock space quantization in terms of Fock spaces and Fock spaces minus, and the free scalar field, we know how it acts on this Fock space. And what I just wanted to emphasize here is that because the 2 degrees of freedom of the theory are in the scalar fields, this is actually the quantum Hilbert space for the entire gravity dilaton matter system. It looks like it only represents the matter field, but because the other variables of the theory are determined by the matter, we also become operators which act on this Koch space, and this is really the physical state space of the theory. Let us now go to the equations which define the other operators. So the operator equations are simply obtained by substituting the operators phi hat and theta hat for phi and theta in the equations, classical equations, which I already told you about. And one also has operator-valued boundary conditions, which relate phi hat theta hat to t hat plus plus and t hat minus minus at psi plus left and psi minus right of this Minkowskian plane. These equations, as I said, there are gaps. There is an open issue over here. And this has to do with the fact that one of the ingredients in this equation is the stress-energy tensor. I already told you that defining the stress-energy tensor, even given a background space-time, is a non-trivial exercise. Here we have a fully quantum space-time, and one really does not know how to define quantum field theory on quantum space-time. So we shall just assume that there is some definition of t hat a b in terms of this, in terms of the geometry, omega hat, just as in the semi-classical case, and we shall go forward. So there are gaps, but the framework is clear. There is the quantum arena, which is the full Minkowskian plane, and we have the physical state space of the theory, and we hope that these operators phi hat and theta hat can again be solved in terms of the fundamental degrees of freedom, which are operator valued here, namely f hat. So while it seems hard, I think progress can be made in defining these equations properly if one takes recourse to some developments in the algebraic quantum field theory community. But I shall not be talking about that here. This is for future work. So as I keep emphasizing, this bare framework itself allows an analysis of the information loss problem, and that is what I shall talk about in the remaining part of the talk. And I just have a note, just once again to emphasize, that the F plus plus F minus is a Hilbert space for the entire system, not only for the matter. So let's now go to page 13. Now since one has full quantum theory, one doesn't have a classical solution, it is necessary to pause a minute and phrase the question of information loss in terms of the structures of the full quantum theory. The first thing one has to do is to tell oneself that there is a black hole, and therefore what we shall do is choose a quantum black hole state, and this quantum black hole state is just mirrored, it's an analog of the classical data which actually form the black hole supercollapse. So the classical data was F minus equal to 0 and F equal to F plus. And we shall choose as a quantum black hole state a coherent state which is modeled on the classical field F plus. So that is given by the ket F plus. Tensor producted is a coherent state model on the classical data F minus equal to 0, and that is just a vacuum state 0 minus. So these are coherent states with respect to the eta AB flat space time, because that is the only arena we have, and this is what we shall designate as a quantum black hole state. Given this, the information loss issue takes the following form. What happens to the zero minus part of the state during black hole evaporation? As I already told you, if one is looking at what happens to the plus objects in which travel from right to left in the classical theory, since the left scribe plus is really not it does not have a black hole kind of character, we are not interested in what happens over there, and the right question to ask is what is the one which I have written on the transparency, namely what happens to the zero minus part of the state during black hole evaporation. So once again, I can pause if there are any more questions.
Madhavan, you mentioned something,
yes.
But I just want to make a small comment because we have in audience some more experts who are mathematically oriented.
Okay.
That this problem of trying to define the trace anomaly and therefore the stress energy tensor on quantum geometry seems really feasible for some rigorous people. Classically, the trace anomaly is determined just by the scalar curvature of the background metric. So it is just basically logarithm of the conformal factor. Sorry, is the second derivative of the logarithm of the conformal factor. Now the conformal factor is operator value, and so one can formally define this logarithm, and the derivative is no problem at all, because the derivative is with respect to the flat space. And so some rigorous people could actually give a meaning to this operator, and so this is a very nice problem. I know that people in Hamburg are online, and they might be able to talk with Freden Hagen, who has worked along these lines to really solve this problem.
Okay, thanks for that. Okay, so if there are no more comments or questions, I'll proceed. So let's now go to page 14, which has the headline trial solution to the operator equation. So in order to get to at least start off by getting some intuition about what these operator equations say, and in order to see that really one does get the right physics out of these equations, let us try to get one solution. And this, I mean, there is not much room for guessing, because the only metric we have in order to define a stress energy tensor in the game is a flat metric, eta AB. So let us just use it to try and define the stress energy tensor. Let us regularize the stress energy tensor of the scalar field F hat using this flat metric. Of course, this is not physically the correct thing to do, because as was pointed out by Abhay in his comment, and as I had said before, it's really the quantum geometry which has to play a part in the definition of T hat AB. Nevertheless, let me just go ahead and do this and see what comes out. If one does this, then of course, it's just black space time physics as far as the scalar field goes, and the trace of the stress energy tensor is zero. One is just normal ordering the stress energy tensor with respect to the flat metric. If one does this, then one can actually solve the operator equations explicitly. So phi hat and theta hat can be explicitly solved in terms of the stress energy tensor operator. And what one can do is now take the expectation value of phi hat times theta hat inverse, which is a conformal factor operator. One can take this expectation value in the quantum black hole state. So this is an operator which acts on this fundamental Fock space of the theory, and one can evaluate its expectation value. And what one gets is exactly the classical conformal factor appropriate to the scalar field data, F plus and F minus equal to zero. Therefore, one can ask what happens at the classical singularity. At the classical singularity, omega classical is actually zero. That's why one has a classical singularity in the curvature. And over here, therefore, the expectation value of omega hat operator is zero. However, phi hat and theta hat are still well defined as operators at the singularity. And in fact, everywhere on this Minkowskian spacetime. In particular, on the singularity, one can ask what the signature of this, the fact that there is a classical singularity, what signature does this have in the underlying quantum theory? And it turns out that one can compute the fluctuations of omega hat appropriately smeared, and it has extremely large fluctuations near this classical singularity, thus showing that classical geometry is really not to be trusted near what used to be the classical singularity. The expectation value geometry is not a good approximation to the actual physics. As I mentioned, phi hat and theta hat are not only well defined at this classical singular line, but well defined on the whole Minkowskian plane, because really that is the arena for the quantum theory. And therefore, phi hat and theta hat are defined even, so to speak, above the classical singularity, and there is a quantum extension of the classical space-time, and the quantum extension is simply the entire Z plus Z minus plane. So let me now go to page 15, where the Penrose diagram shows you the expectation value geometry. So the expectation value geometry is simply obtained by taking defining the contravariant metric JB to the expectation value of omega hat operator and the flat metric eta IB. And it matches exactly with the classical geometry below this wiggly line, which is a singularity where omega hat expectation value vanishes. However, omega hat is well defined above the singularity, and its expectation value can be computed over there. And one can go ahead and compute it, but it's not really very enlightening, because to begin with, this choice of eta AB underlying the regularization of T hat AB is not a physically well-defined, is not a physically well-motivated choice, so I will not go into the details of the geometry above the singularity. Now, so far so good. Is there a Hawking effect? Can we say anything about the Hawking effect with regard to this particular operator solution of these equations? And the answer is actually yes. So what one can do is one can look at this non-perturbative quantum state of the gravity dilaton matter system, which is just F plus cross 0 minus, and one can ask, what does 0 minus look like when seen by asymptotic inertial observers in the expectation value geometry at chi plus classical? So this is just asking what this state looks like to observers of the classical black hole geometry. But recall that this is not a test quantum field anymore. This is really a part of the non-perturbative full quantum state of the system. It turns out that 0 minus, interpreted by asymptotic inertial observers in the expectation value geometry, exactly gives you Hawking radiation. Namely, the late time behavior of this state is exactly a thermal state with a temperature independent of the mass and exactly the Hawking temperature. So the solution to these operator equations, even though not completely well physically motivated, does capture a lot of the physics which one would like it to. However, it is not the complete story, because this radiation which is coming out, this Hawking radiation, has no back reaction in this picture. Because the expectation value geometry is exactly the classical geometry, it does not change because of emission of Hawking radiation. And of course, this inconsistency was to be expected, because we simply used this auxiliary fact metric to start defining the stress energy tensor operator. Now, what one can do instead of just stopping here is to try and make this a zeroth step of a bootstrapping procedure. So this was a first guess, and one can take the solution to the operator equation which one has and try now to go to put it back and do some sort of a bootstrapping. I won't describe this bootstrapping procedure in any detail, because it doesn't go anywhere. And the reason it doesn't go anywhere is already at the zeroth step of bootstrapping, one has an expectation value geometry which is singular, and therefore one cannot really say much about what happens in the causal shadow of the singularity. So instead of going along this, pushing this further, what I will do is I will talk about another approximation in which to understand quantum equations and the quantum theory, and we shall see that it gives us some insight about the information loss problem. So let me then go to page 16. So let me look at the equations in the context of another approximation. So let me take the expectation value of the operator equations directly with respect to the quantum black hole state. And while I'm taking this expectation value, let me neglect fluctuations of the gravity and dilaton operators, namely the phi hat operators and the theta hat operators. So typically I would replace objects like log of theta hat, expectation value of log of theta hat, by log of expectation value of theta hat. So I'm neglecting fluctuations of phi at the theta at operator, but I will not neglect fluctuations of the matter operator. If one does this, then one gets the exact analog of semi-classical gravity four-dimensional equations. So just to remind you what they are, those equations simply are the Einstein tensor, four dimensions, equal to 8 pi g times not the classical stress energy tensor, but the expectation value of the stress energy tensor operator. And this expectation value is computed in the metric for which the Einstein tensor is evaluated on the left-hand side. So it's a highly coupled system, and these are the equations one gets. So I just want to emphasize that these equations are different from the equations which dictate quantum fields on curved space-time. There, the metric is just given once and for all, but here, the expectation value of the stress energy tensor drives the metric which defines the Einstein tensor. So one gets the exact analog of the semi-classical gravity equation for the CGHS model. And these equations I shall call the mean field equations. And the mean field equations for this model have been studied extensively, both analytically and numerically. So numerically by Pirant, Schrödinger and Lowe, and analytically by Susskind and Tholisius. And what they find is depicted on the Penrose diagram on page 17. So what happens? You have again these dots, which represents the classical matter collapse. If you look at the left future part of this diagram, then you will see that the singularity has actually receded from left described class. And therefore it is naked from the left. But this is, nothing new has been qualitatively added, because as I told you, left sky class to start off with was incomplete and the singularity was already left naked. A dynamical horizon actually forms, which in the appropriate analogs, one can define horizons in two dimensions. And if there are questions at the end, I can come back to this point. But there is a dynamical horizon form, which is space-like. So it starts off space-like as long as matter is collapsing. Becomes null once the matter collapse has stopped, and once Hawking radiation starts, because the Hawking radiation also backreacts on the geometry, the horizon actually becomes time-like. The dynamical horizon becomes time-like, and this is very, very much like what has been proposed in the Ashtekar-Boyle-Wall paradigm. The singularity, however, the fact that there is a singularity persists, and the mean field equations also finally end up in a singularity, and the numerical code simply, of course, just breaks down over here. However, what seems to happen is that most of the mass of the space-time has already come out by the time the singularity is formed in terms of Hawking radiation. So basically all the mass of the space-time is already out onto sky plus right when this code breaks down. From our point of view, we have an underlying quantum theory which we would believe resolves the singularities of both the classical theory or any approximation thereto, and therefore this wiggly line should actually be a place where the mean field approximation breaks down. As we have already seen in the trial solution, there are large fluctuations of the quantum geometry near singularities, and therefore mean field equations, which assumed that the fluctuations of the gravity dilaton sector could be neglected, themselves become invalid near the singularity. So is there therefore a place where one could still trust the mean field equations on this diagram? And the answer is yes. If one goes out to null infinity, so let me go out to future right null infinity, that is really where the issue of information loss is to be examined. Since we are at asymptotic null infinity, one would expect the gravitational fields to be small. One would expect there to be small fluctuations, and one would expect the mean field approximation to still be valid over there. So what I'm going to do is now look at the equations coming from the mean field approximation near sky plus right of this Minkowski plane. So let me then go to page 18. So this has a header, asymptotic analysis, left, right, left, right. And let me just summarize what happens. It turns out that the knowledge of this underlying deep quantum state of the CGTM system, namely the fact that one has a state which is F plus cross cross 0 minus, the knowledge of the fact that one has this state, is together with the mean field equations near scribe pulse right, quite strongly constrain the response of the asymptotic geometry to the energy flux at scribe pulse right. So we didn't think that it would be so constraining, but when you do the things, it actually turns out that this is quite a tight system. And the analysis of the equations implies, as put in an almost, which I think now can be dropped, uniquely the following. So, supposing the Hawking flux smoothly vanishes along sky plus right of the physical space-time. So I want to emphasize that this is not the sky plus right of the flat space-time. It is the sky plus right of the physical space-time. The sky plus right of the physical space-time coincides with that of the flat space-time at, so to speak, early times. But what happens afterwards, we don't know. Whether sky plus right is just a part of the sky plus right of eta I b, or whether it is an extension of that, what actually it is, we do not know. However, if the Hawking flux is assumed to smoothly vanish along sky plus right of the physical space-time, then sky plus right of the physical space-time coincides with the sky plus right of the flat space-time. Thus, again, I want to emphasize this point. Knowledge of this underlying quantum state and the mean field equations near asymptotic with null infinity at the right together tell us that there is really an extension of the classical sky plus right, and this extension is the sky plus right of the fiducial fat space time. So the mean field equations together with this assumption tell us this. And this assumption is quite physically reasonable because already the numerical analysis seems to indicate that almost all the energy actually comes out due to Hawking radiation, and therefore the Hawking radiation must switch off. And what we have assumed is that it switches off smoothly. Secondly, let us now go to sky plus right, and we know it has been extended to sky plus right of the fiducial space-time, the flat vector z minus plane. Let us go to the asymptotic freely falling coordinates of this physical metric at sky plus right, and let me call the associated null coordinates to be y plus and y minus. Then clearly, because of two dimensions and because of the structure, y minus near sky plus right is only a function of z minus. And one can ask now, what does the state 0 minus, which is a vacuum with respect to the z minus observers, what does this state look like to the y minus observers? And what one can show is that 0 minus is actually a normalized pure state in the Hilbert space of the y observers. Hence, there is no information loss in this system. So the 0 minus state, which is the pure state of the full quantum gravity Dilaton matter system, remains a pure state under evolution if one looks at sky plus right. So let me then go to page 19. And again, I suppose let me pause for just a few seconds if there are any questions at this point. Okay, so since I'm running a little bit late, let me tell you what the final story is. So let's now go to the final picture, which comes about as a result of this all these different ingredients. The final picture is as follows. So at early times, one has a geometry which looks pretty much like the classical theories. One has matter collapsing with these dotted, designated by these dots, the flat space-time. And then the mean field approximation equations tell us that the dynamical horizon forms. The expectation is that the deep quantum theory resolves the singularity, and therefore the wiggly line of the mean field approximation space-time is replaced by some quantum region. So this, of course, is informed speculation, which will have to be justified. Then one can go out to Sky Plus Right and do asymptotic analysis there, and one can see that at a certain point, which is self-evident from the Penrose diagram, beyond that point the flux is zero. Thus, just to summarize, the interior to the past is the mean field approximation singularity is given by mean field approximation numerics. Near Sky Plus Right, we have asymptotic analysis, and the conceptual underpinnings of this whole picture are provided by the operator equations, which suggest singularity resolution and extension of classical space-time to a larger arena, which is the full Minkowskian thing. Let me go to page 50. So let me now revisit the information loss problem from this perspective. I have drawn the same Penrose diagram, except that on Sky Plus Right, I have designated three points. P0, which is before the Hawking flux stops, P, which is roughly the point at which the Hawking flux stops, and P1, which is to the future of that point. So as I mentioned, the first statement is that 0 minus is actually a pure state in the Hilbert space of the asymptotic observers at Sky Plus Right. Secondly, there is no information loss. Secondly, beyond P, there is no energy flux. All the energy has already come out. But there is no remnant. I mean, if one looks at the mean field approximation equations and its solution, there is no sign of any remnant with large number of internal states. Nevertheless, one can go ahead and compute operator correlations. So one can take the operator F at P1 and F at P0, compute the two-point function in the state 0 minus, and one just gets the standard two-point function. I'm being a bit glib over here. What one should compute is derivatives of these F hat operators, not F hat themselves due to infrared problems. But nevertheless, there are infinite, the state beyond P1 or beyond P is very highly correlated with the state before P. And therefore, even in the absence of particles, there are these quantum field correlations. So that is one very important lesson which at least we have learned from this model. Let me now go to page 21, where I shift from correlations to entropy. While field correlations are just well-defined, one can simply take the operators, two-point functions, and compute expectation values, entropy requires an additional structure. So intuitively, what one would like to do when one is computing entropy at Sky Plus Right, one would like to take particle modes to the future of P and trace over them. Where over here, P need not be the point where Hawking radiation stops, it could be any point on Sky Plus, right? And one would like to define the entropy which one sees up to P, and that could be obtained simply by tracing over particle modes with respect to the asymptotic observers to the future of that kind of P. However, since I've already said in the digression that particle modes are always spread out, you cannot localize them at P and they have tails. So nevertheless, if one can live with these tails, one can go ahead and do this computation, that is trace out modes to the future of P, and one can see what happens. So it turns out, just given Bogle-Bohr transformation technology, that 0 minus is given by sum of even number of particle states at Sky Plus Right, and the sum on the right is normalizable. One can take these particle states in terms of wave packets and make them peaked about points on Sky Plus Right, and one can trace over these particles whose peaks are beyond any point P one wants, and one can get a density matrix operator. One can take the entropy of this operator, simply trace rho hat log rho hat, and what one can show is the following, namely that in the remote past, the entropy goes to zero, so this is much before Hawking radiation has really started properly. It increases to the future, and once there is Hawking radiation, some amount of Hawking radiation has happened, at some point it decreases. And it decreases to zero beyond the point P. And the information then is really in the correlations between these pairs of particles which are emitted at different times along sky plus right. The detailed picture is still emerges as to when the information comes out, etc., etc. So this will work under progress. Nevertheless, what I've said is what one can say even at this stage. Just a note before I end, the mean field approximation, which plays such an important role in our consideration, actually requires not one matter field, but 10 matter fields, where n is sufficiently large. But this has no obstruction to our non-perturbative quantization, and one can take care of this fine, because all these n-matter fields actually are confinedly coupled, and this simply travels on the flat space time. So let me then summarize. So non-perturbative quantization of this model, combined with mean field approximation numerics and some analytical work, plus asymptotic analysis, all together point towards a unitary picture of black hole evaporation, which has the following key features, which are robust enough that they can be defined also in four dimensions. And these features are singularity resolution. This is expected. This is something which is informed speculation. An extension of classical space-time. So this comes already when one defines the quantum theory in terms of FI plus and FI minus operators. And the final lesson which I'd like you to take away is that there's really no such thing as classically empty space-time with no fluctuations at all. There is always this underlying quantum state, and as we have seen, even though there are no particles, there is the quantum field is always there, and that fluctuates, and that has correlations, even though there is no particle over there in the sky plus right. So again, just to mention that this work was done in collaboration with Avayashtika and with Tata. Okay, thanks.
Any questions?
Well, let me ask the obvious question. This is very beautiful work. Do you think there's any chance that some of these techniques could extend to higher dimensions?
I don't have any concrete way, but yes, I think that at least for spherical collapse, I was just discussing with Abhay yesterday, that there might be ways to proceed. And maybe if Abhay wants, he can say a little bit more. Because we were just discussing this very question yesterday. I think the answer is yes. At least in the case of spherical collapse, one should be able to make some sort of an argument of a similar nature. For me, the key point is really that if one has... It's quite physically reasonable that the Hawking radiation switches off at some stage. And this, from the point of view of linear field theory, and that is really what doesn't happen in the higher dimensional case, the field equations are not this linear operator equation for the matter. But taking over intuition from the linear case, the reason why the state which you start off initially is still in the Hilbert space of the final sky plus right is because there is good ultraviolet behavior. And this good ultraviolet behavior comes from the fact that the total energy in the final state, which is seen by the final observers, is finite, because the total Hawking radiation physically cannot exceed the mass of the black hole you started out with. So I think that there are reasons to believe that for the spherically symmetric collapse case, maybe one can do something more. To provide any comments then.
I would just say that I just basically can reinforce what Madhavan said. Madhavan had written down this action for the CGHS model, the two-dimensional model. And if we just go to that transparency, maybe it's not easy. It is. It is transparency 8.
Okay.
So. So, if I start with the four-dimensional spherical collapse with a scalar field, again, F, but in the spherically symmetric context, then we can also, again, do dimensional reduction. Basically, this radius of the two spheres, R, can be written as e to the phi divided by kappa. Because kappa gives the dimension and e to the phi is dimensionless. So e to the phi gives the magnitude. Then the reduction of the action looks almost exactly like the action in the CGHS model. There is just a fact, is one factor of 4 is replaced by 2. But more importantly, in the matter term, there is also a dilutonic term, e to the minus phi, coming up here, which is not there in the CGHS model. But because the equations are so similar, it does seem that the intuition that we had gained from two dimensions will carry over to the four-dimensional context. But as Madhavan was saying, this dilaton factor in the action actually makes the scalar field equation coupled with the dilaton. It cannot be solved in its own right. Therefore, we cannot literally take over the results from the two dimensions. But very similar asymptotic analysis should be possible. And I think that this is a, you know, kind of a right problem that can be solved, hopefully in the near future. Four-dimensional spherical symmetric collapse. Of course, to solve it exactly is highly non-trivial, because in two dimensions, Madhavan showed us how to solve the problem completely classically. But in four dimensions, we know there are very subtle things like chopped phenomena and such things. So the problem is more, you know, analytic solutions is not going to be so easy. But the asymptotic analysis and so on, I think, will be possible again. And one should be able to draw similar conclusions in four dimensions as well.
Very good.
Let's see, so I've heard an objection that unfortunately I can't remember very well, so maybe Abhay or someone else in the audience can help me out. In the past, people have considered models of evaporation of black holes where some sort of nugget forms and some remnant of planet scale forms and then re-radiates away things. And the arguments have been made that this cannot happen because such nuggets are just too small and cannot produce the right correlations to restore unitarity. Have you thought about that or heard about that?
Okay. Rahul, do you want to take it or should I?
Why don't you say it and if I have some comments, yeah. I can add.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that really, in at least from the CGHS case, there does not seem to be any reason to believe that there are remnants, or that the remnants play any big role in the sense that they, you know, even if they are there is no reason to really assume that they have a large number of internal states. The purity of the state is really appears due to correlations which are internal to the Hawking radiation. There are also arguments as to why the information cannot come out in terms of correlations between just purely from the Hawking radiation. But these arguments, if one looks at them, actually rest on various assumptions which are all suspect. One of the assumptions is that the causal structure of the space-time is such that there is something like an event horizon, which simply is not true over here. A second assumption is that it is easy to define a split of states between, so if one takes a Cauchy slice in the space-time at the time at which things are collapsing, suppose there is an event horizon, there is an internal part of the slice and an external part, and one assumes in the arguments which are given, these are these quantum bleaching arguments, that the state can be written unambiguously as an in-state plus an out-state. I mean, I've already argued that in the context of the quantization which you looked at, that such a sharp splitting in and out is not possible. You can't localize things that well. And there is always going to be tails. So there is also an objection. I mean, the argument is suspect even for that. And thirdly, there is an even more fundamental reason why the arguments of Preskill are, and other people, I don't know who came up with these arguments initially, are suspect. And that is that somehow the way they structure this is that they change the initial state of the collapsing state, and they say that the final state has to change in such a way that the in part of the state is always going to be the same. That's the only way in which you can get a pure state. And this whole separation of in and out depends on a particular representation of this structure in terms of a Penrose diagram. And when you change the initial state, when you write the same space-time diagram, there is an intuitive identification of two different space-times, one with one initial state, one with another initial state. And this identification, again, is something which is suspect from the point of view of full quantum theory. So I think it would take more time for me to sort of say things now, but maybe I can put this in some section.
Yeah, okay. I think Madhavan has given kind of the deep arguments, really. We spent a lot, months and months, in going through the literature and seeing if something is wrong in what we are saying, basically. And Madhavan is telling us how various arguments made by Preskill, by Susskind, and by various other people have holes in them. But I think I just would like to return to the question that Jorge was asking and just sort of provide a sort of a simpler answer to that. And the question is really the following. One says that the black hole has been evaporating for a very long time, and therefore it is actually emitting Hawking radiation. By that one means a thermal state. And therefore, there are correlations between that thermal state and something that is left over. I'm giving the standard argument. And then the argument is that this assumption or this scenario continues until the black hole has a Planck scale mass. And therefore, there has been a thermal radiation all along at infinity, which is correlated with this Planck scale mass. But that is not possible because such objects which are Planck scale mass and such large bits of information don't really exist. If they existed, we should see them when, for example, two cars collide. So this is the kind of argument that people give. What is happening in the CGHS model, why this argument is bypassed, is the following. When we speak of Hawking radiation, we just mean the image of the vacuum state in the past, image at future infinity. So what is the physical content of the vacuum state in the past as seen by observers at future infinity? The Hawking, this radiated state, this image state that we get, is a pure state. So it is, even when the radiation is coming out, it is not true that we have a thermal radiation all along. Roughly, the picture can be divided into three epochs. At future null infinity, if you are in the distant past near spatial infinity, then there is no Hawking radiation or negligible one. Then there is a lot of Hawking radiation. It actually switches on very rapidly. One can check that. And then there is this flux of Hawking radiation. In the external field approximation, you just have this flux of Hawking radiation. That's it until the end. In the picture that we have with the back reaction, there is a second phase in which there is really this Hawking radiation. But then the quantum space-time is bigger than the classical space-time, and therefore the Hawking therefore this radiation actually continues on. And what is coming out at late times in the extended space-time is correlated with what came out in the in-between time, which was supposed to be the Hawking radiation. So the idea is that even if you restrict yourself to the part of non-infinity where there is non-trivial radiation, the state you would obtain in our picture is a pure state. If you truncate it at an in-between time, it would approximate the thermal state extremely well, but it is nonetheless a pure state. So there really is no remnant at all. All the correlations are restored already at null infinity, not with something which is in the space-time, which is left over as a remnant. Is that roughly clear, Jorge?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Can I query that? Because there are two things that could be going on here, and can you tell me which one it is? If you have your three stages, roughly speaking, you're saying that if you took the trace of the state at null infinity before the third stage began, you have entropy. And then in the third stage, there are correlations which restore the entropy back to zero. I think the question is, do the degrees of freedom which reach null infinity and restore the pure state, do they come from the region of the black hole from a time on the order of the evaporation time, so that as the black hole is evaporating, later quanta correlate with earlier quanta, which is a possibility that some people discuss, or do these quanta that correlate with the earlier quanta come really after it's sensible to talk about there being a classical black hole?
No, so the first one.
Is that a clear question?
Yes. So it is the first possibility. I want to say that to really answer these questions with complete confidence, what we need is a numerical solution, evolution of actually getting explicit form of the function of y that Madhavan wrote down in terms of z. This has not been done. So what I can tell you is what I believe to be the case based on the qualitative analysis. And the case is the first one. That is to say, correlations are slowly restored, in other words, the third stage, at the onset of the third stage, space-time can still be taken to be classical. There is still a lot of mass, so to say, left over in the black hole. So the correlations are not restored by radiation coming out when the black hole has entered a pure quantum region. The restoration starts much, much earlier.
That's extremely interesting. Can you estimate the time, the proportion of mass left at the transition between the second and third stage?
Yeah, so I do not... So this is a $100,000 question. This is the question, really, that I would like to know the answer to. I do not have a reliable estimate. This is particularly interesting when we go to the four-dimensional black holes, because, as Madhavan said, in the four-dimensional case, you would expect some of the collapsing matter itself become a non-trivial quantum state and so on, and then come out, and the rest being evaporated in the Hawking radiation. How much is radiated in the Hawking radiation, and how much is the matter that comes, quote-unquote, through what was a classical singularity, depends exactly on these time scales. If the whole process takes very long time, then almost all the matter would come out in terms of radiation. It would be much more like what we saw in a two-dimensional picture. If, in fact, a non-negligible fraction of the matter, say 10% or 20%, comes out as matter itself, and only 80% comes out as Hawking radiation, then that would mean that the evaporation scale is less than what we believe to be based on the quantum field theory in curved space-time picture. So I do not know the answer to the key question you are asking, which is really the question about these time scales at which, so to say, the third stage switches on and the duration of the third stage, basically. But one of the assumptions all along has been that information that the thermal radiation description should be accurate, because the process is so quasi-static. And what I am saying, and what Martin and I already said in this older paper, is that, yes, but there are small errors all along. And there is such a long time for them to accumulate that purity can be restored in this third stage. That is to say that we do not have to believe that the radiation is thermal throughout the evaporation process. But just a short answer to your question is, I do not know the time scales, and I would love to know that. And that, to me, is a key question.
I mean, very good.
Yeah, any other criticism or questions, I really would greatly appreciate them. And I'm sure that Madhavan and Victor would too.
Any further questions? Okay, let's thank Madhavan again.